Hello, I'm Brian.
And I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
This is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
Welcome back to the podcast. We've been away for a week, had a little break, but we're back. So looking ahead to what we're going to be talking about, Caroline, you're going to move a little bit away from your usual...
Yes. Oh my God. Opening with such a pun. Yes, I am going to just run through some of the updates that have happened this week around Huawei and its dicey relationship with the UK government.
More on that soon. Claire, Women in Tech, new migration rules for IT professionals. You're covering a couple of things off there.
Yep, just some of the stuff that's been happening over the last couple of weeks in my various areas of coverage.
Like Claire, I'm going to stick to my patches and I'm going to talk about the government's very keen and quite strange focus on data as a way to revolutionise the state, revolutionise all of our lives. Anyway, more on that towards the end of the podcast. We'll start with Caroline. So,
yeah, it's been a real rollercoaster few months for Huawei, hasn't it? And I say that as a bystander, an observer of all of this. As you said, Brian, I don't tend to delve too deeply into the murky world of networking. So a lot of the reporting on this story so far has been done by our colleagues, Joe O'Halloran, and in a past life, Alex Scroxton as well. So there's loads to read up on if you're coming to this story brand new. Cutting a very long story short, the company's been having to deal with the fact that various governments around the world have been imposing restrictions on the use of its networking technology, including most notably the US and Australia. In the UK, the government announced in January 2020 that it wouldn't be following suit by banning Huawei's kit from Britain's burgeoning 5G infrastructure. But, you know, as we all know, living in the COVID economy right now, a lot can happen in 6 months. And this week, the government ordered the removal of all Huawei equipment from the UK's 5G infrastructure by 2027. And also by the end of this year, telcos are being ordered not to acquire any new 5G equipment from the company either. And on top of that, there's also going to be a bill passed in due course that's going to make it illegal for telcos to acquire its technology as well. So it's a huge blow, really, to Huawei in terms of being able to do business in the UK. Its technology is a huge part of our infrastructure already. So ordering its removal is going to have huge ramifications for telcos having to remove that technology and replace it. What with will the technologies out there, will they be equivalent to what Huawei can offer? It's going to cause a huge amount of disruption. So the culture secretary Oliver Dowden said the U-turn has been taken because the UK can no longer guarantee the future security of Huawei's equipment. So his actual quote was, by the end of the next election, before December 2024, we'll have implemented in law an irreversible path for the complete removal of Huawei's equipment from our 5G network. That's like a huge, huge U-turn, given like just 6 months ago, they're like, nah, it's fine. We're going to keep it. You know, Australia, USA, you do you, but the UK, we're all good.
Like super intense to be like, this is an irreversible change.
Yeah, I know. And so it's going to cause so much disruption, but it's clearly not a decision the government has taken lightly. It acknowledged that this change in opinion on Huawei's technology means the pace of the UK's 5G rollout is likely to be a lot slower and more costly.
I don't know, maybe you might have to cut all of this out, but I bet the conspiracy theorists are all over that. Well, aren't there already like conspiracy theorists that are saying that like 5G caused coronavirus, and now they're like, see, now Huawei is like banned in the UK and 5G is going to be...
Yeah, because I mean the reasons they've given, which I was going to get onto in a minute, are kind of they are a bit vague and a bit kind of, well, we don't know exactly what what exactly is the cause. But like I said, they've mentioned, oh, you know, we're worried about the resiliency of the networks by keeping this technology within our infrastructure, but we're also concerned about the security of it. But then also at the same time, there's trade policy in the US. Like we need to keep the US on side at the moment. So there's been accusations that maybe the UK government have been put under pressure by US lobbyists to follow suit, because we work together. You follow what the US has done by getting rid of Huawei's equipment, because it works best for you. So like I say, it's kind of vague. So yeah, you could see how a conspiracy theory could, grow legs and take root on them.
Well, I think the dressing it up a bit is a technical decision because Huawei's kit has become less good because they can't get the suppliers from the US because the US isn't allowing them to get the chips and stuff that they need. So it's as a consequence of something that the US has done to Huawei.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so that has been sort of alluded to in some of the responses from Huawei that, you know, they've basically made the point that this isn't necessarily, you know, technology or security decision. It's a trade policy decision, you know, based around lots of things. But it looks like it's going to be costly for the UK's 5G rollout. The current estimates from the government are that on the back of this action, removing its technology from our 5G infrastructure means the rollout of 5G is likely to take 2 to 3 years longer than currently planned. And also it's going to cost about at least £2 billion more to do it because, like I say, you've got to rip out and replace all this, make sure it's equivalent functionality. It's going to cause problems.
It may have an impact on people who've got those lovely Huawei mobile phones that have got great cameras in them. And maybe put all of their mobile phone bills up. I've seen some commentary about that.
Well, that's the thing. If the telco community have got to... let's say rip out and replace infrastructure, and this is going to be an additional cost to their operations over time. So somewhere along the line, they've got to make up those costs. So of course, it'll probably be passed on to us. Yeah, that's definitely going to happen. This big decision was announced this week, but it's been something that's been brewing for a little while. There was last year, there was this UK government released its telecom supply chain review document, which basically called on the National Cybersecurity Centre to consider issuing guidance to UK telcos on companies they regarded as posing security and resiliency threats to UK networks. And there were two notable companies in that. One was Huawei and the other one was another Chinese manufacturer called ZTE. So this has been sort of, there's been conversations on the back of that brewing for a while about, like, oh, you know, if they're looking at Huawei like this, could that mean at some point their technology is banned or the use of it's restricted? So it's all been, like I say, that this has been brewing for a while, but the announcement this week was, you know, a very firm, definite, like, right, okay, it's off the table, the use of their technology. The big questions in all of this are, you know, with USA, Australia, and now the UK rolling out restrictions on the use of Huawei's technology, what does that mean for Huawei and its future business prospects? You know, that's one thing that needs to be looked at. I mean, they have said already that they will, you know, on the back of this news, they're going to need to conduct a review of what, you know, this means for its business in the UK. But they've also said they're going to continue to support their existing customers. Also, they want to work with the UK government to see if there's anything they can do to maybe get them to roll back any of their decisions, or maybe, you know, maybe form some kind of response or defence against this happening. Because it's unclear, really, if there has been any... if Huawei has been given any opportunities to sort of respond to any of this or push back against any of it. You know, it doesn't sound like they're taking this lying down necessarily. Yeah. And I guess the other thing as well, you do have to wonder what all this means for kind of Chinese-UK sort of trade relations at a time when the UK really needs all the friends it can get on an international trading front, you know, thanks to Brexit. So there's that to take into consider. But yeah, Huawei have described the news as disappointing. And well, actually, they've sort of said that the UK is at risk of levelling down in terms of its digital ambitions by ridding them from the network. So it sounds like a messy breakup. Yeah, and like I said, they're very much of the view that it's a decision that's being guided by US trade policy rather than genuine security concerns. Yeah, as someone who has admittedly tracked this story from a distance, you do get the feeling that perhaps that is not a wide of the mark assessment of what's gone on here, to be honest. They want to continue working with the UK government, though, despite being thrown out, and in their words, continue to contribute to a better connected Britain.
Sorry, I suppose they are quite connected and embedded, because their tech is very embedded in BT's technology, Vodafone and so on for 4G and 3G and all the other Gs. I don't really know much about telecoms, but they are in there. And they're also in our educational system quite strongly. And they've got strong links with Cambridge, Edinburgh, Surrey, some other places, you know, so they've got and they've got 1,600 employees in the UK.
Yeah. Mm. So they haven't said what exactly, you know, their plan is on the back of this. But yeah, you could, like I said, for their future in the UK, you know, it's got to at least put a small question mark above that in terms of how they go forward if they can't get any concessions on the government from the government on this. Or in the meantime, I'm probably going to hold off on buying a 5G capable phone for not if they're not even get the network for another 2-3 years. Yeah, we'll just have to see how this one plays out. I've got a feeling it's not, you know, the last we're going to hear about any of it.
No, the story's going to be with us for a long time. I wonder if the Chinese and the Americans, if they become best buddies again, then that would change things.
Yeah, like I say, it's a bit like a breakup at the moment. So at the moment, it could be like, you know, the US and UK start like chatting behind China's back, like, oh God, we don't even like them. And then suddenly, if the US gets back together with China, we're going to look like the terrible people for, you know, engaging in any sort of bitching about them. Yeah, it's all going to be very messy, very messy.
And I suppose from the US's point of view, it does make sense that they would not want their, how can I put this, technological supremacy that they've had for decades disrupted by China.
Mm-hmm.
They've taken a very aggressive stance
mm.
on this. And it will affect other, presumably it will affect other Chinese IT companies like Tencent and Alibaba.
Mm. Yeah, potentially, yeah.
Ultimately, because there isn't anything. Well, I mean, there's Huawei's involvement in telecom, so I suppose that's a special thing. But yeah, it's an objection to China and the Chinese Communist Party, fundamentally. It's not really a tech thing. It's not because Huawei's kit's a bit rubbish. It's motivated, seems to me, by politics.
Yeah, And that's what Huawei said in their statement. It's like a politicised move rather than, like, say, anything to do with security, technology, or anything else really. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I mean, there's the US elections. Could there be anything there that suddenly, if there's a massive change in power there, would that affect something? Oh, actually, you guys are fine. And like I say, in which case we look like it's okay, sorry Huawei, like the UK government.
Yeah, if Biden becomes president, because Trump was making a great deal about how he'd persuaded the UK to become a clean country by getting rid of Huawei.
Yeah, is very much his usual rhetoric.
So, Caroline, did you enjoy being off your patch there?
It's
to look at something else that's not.
Yeah, I mean, some people would argue that networks are all part of data centers, so it's not strayed too far off my patch. But this is kind of like, this is a good story because it's like a bun fight. There's lots of like, I say, bitching going on. So you're kind of, oh yeah, oh my God, he said what? Yeah, so it's kind of an easy one to get your head around and get involved in. And like I say, it's all too easy to pick sides as well. But yeah, it's quite a nice kind of gossipy story. Easy and accessible.
Now, Claire and I are sticking, as I said, to our patches for our talking points today. Can you talk us through the makers list, first of all? Thank you.
Yeah, so the Makers Women in Software Power List, it's something that they started last year. This is the second year in a row that they've run it. It's basically, much like our list, a list of the top 30 women in software who were sort of considered like the rising stars in the software development industry. Basically, they want to make sure that role models are accessible in the sector, accessible and visible, much like our list. You know, like, we want to make sure that as many people are showcased as possible. One of the reasons being that there's this theory that a lot of young people, young women especially, don't choose to go into technology type roles because they don't really see anyone else like them in those roles. So they sort of don't think of it as a career or a route that they can take. So the thinking is that the more of these sort of like lists that there are that are showcasing all of the people that are at different levels in their career, doing different jobs in technology, that more people can see that and then think of it as something that's actually attainable. So this is one of the lists that we support. It's slightly different from our list in that the people on it have only sort of like been in their roles for up to 10 years, I think it is. So it's people who have, you know, like only been in their role for 10 years or under. So that's why they're considered sort of like the rising stars in the software sector, because, you know, like it's more about people who are coming up in the sector, whereas ours is the most influential. So it's, you know, like people who are already sort of like quite far along in their careers, I would say. So yeah, they released their new list at the beginning of this week. At time that the podcast comes out, it will be last week. So there were 30 women on there who are all really awesome in the software development sector. definitely worth checking out.
I really like the job titles and stuff because these are young women who are doing stuff. Yeah.
Be interesting to know, like, just with the visibility you get from lists like this, if, you know, I don't know if it's something you get through like visibility or through our list we have at Computer Weekly, but yeah, do people get job offers off the back of this? The fact that their profile has risen in this way and something like, oh, I didn't know that, like, say that from the job titles point of view, I didn't even know that was a job. Oh, that's what we need in our organization. Let's have that conversation with that lady and see if she wants to come work with us.
I don't know about that, but I know that some of the people who appear on our top 50 list do put it on their LinkedIn as sort of like something that's an accomplishment. Mm. You know, like an accolade or a recognition. So yeah. I think it is important to these, you know, like to the people that appear on the lists. Because it is sort of like a recognition for all of the hard work that you do, and it can sort of be, you know, like shown as a badge of honor. Like, I've been recognized for being really awesome at what I do, so that's another, you know, like thing to showcase about me and my career.
I'm just thinking as you were talking, Claire, about, yeah, some of the women, the young women on this list are young and maybe are not paid maybe as well as they ought to be and things like that. Because there's another story that you did this week about immigration points tied to the salary level that you have to have. Tell us a bit about that, because I've been trying to mull over how reasonable those numbers are. Like, you have to have 56k to get so many points and things like that.
This is a clarification of some of the rules that might be put in place when we move to a points-based immigration system in the beginning of 2021. So one of the things that they have said is that for the skilled worker route, so to get a visa through sort of like the skilled worker route, you have to have 70 points to earn a visa.
Yeah.
50 of those points are earned by non-negotiable criteria, which are you have to be approved by a sponsor, have a job offer, a sponsor approved job offer at the appropriate skill level, and have the required level of English. Like, those are the things that are non-negotiable. But the other 20 points can sort of be made up in other ways. So one of the ways that you can get it is by having a PhD in the relevant field. The other one is having a job on the shortage occupation list. And then one of them is having a certain salary.
Yeah.
But the rules around whether or not your salary can contribute towards extra points are very complicated. I felt like it was really complicated. Like, it was meant to be a clarification of the rules, but I sat there staring at this document for ages, like, I don't even know how to describe this. But okay, so what I think is correct is that if you earn a salary higher than the general threshold of £25,600 and at least the specified salary for your particular job, then you'll get the extra 20 points that you need for a visa. But they've published documentation based on Office of National Statistics figures that signal the going rate for some of these particular job roles, which, relating back to what you were saying, Brian, about, you know, like software engineers, is not particularly high for someone who's doing web development, for example.
Yeah.
The going rate for a web designer, I think they said, was about 26,000, which doesn't seem like that much. Software developers, 33,300 were sort of like the going rate for something like that. But there seems to be sort of like big gaps. So it says that IT directors, the going rate seems to be 56,100. Which, you know, like, is quite a jump if you look from software developer to IT director. But that also could depend on, you know, like the company and how long they've been in the role. Like, there's quite a lot of stuff that can factor into what your salary is, isn't there?
Mm.
So yeah, that's, you know, like a general summary of it. And obviously there are lots of other different rules and caveats that could mean that you do or don't get the 20 points on top of the 50 non-negotiable. And there are other rules depending on, you know, like if you're a new entrant into the market or if you're a student or all sorts of stuff. It was a very long and complicated document.
Sounds like a very convoluted piece of policy. But,
I think they're going to carry on developing it as it goes along. And obviously those salary going rates might change depending on, you know, like the statistics and the data that comes out every year. But yeah, that's sort of like the general vibe at the minute, as far as I can glean from what I read.
Because my kind of intuition about those salaries is they all look reasonable. I mean, like an IT director, CIO type, 56K seems, if anything, a bit on the low side.
Yeah, that's what I thought. In fact, in some cases, I would think that might even be about half of what they would normally make, isn't it?
I believe so, yeah. Yeah, but I mean, those salaries seem reasonable for IT pros. I mean, obviously, journalists are paid a lot less than some of those numbers. But, you know.
Yeah, wiping my eyes, reading
them. Yeah, where we are. Well, thanks, Claire. Thank you, Claire. One specific government policy, quite a convoluted and complicated one, to data in government. And speaking of jobs, there was a job advertised recently for number 10 by the government, head of the number 10 analytical unit. I'm just going to read out the job description very quickly to try and get this right. So this newly created role will be responsible for establishing number 10's quantitative ability, helping to drive change across Whitehall through the establishment of a newly formed team, 10 Data Science. Sitting in number 10, this unit will transform how we use data to facilitate more effective decision-making at the centre and across government. And the salary is 135,000 for that, or up to 135,000 for that job, if any of us are, you know, tempted to apply for it. Now, you will discern in this, I'm sure we can reasonably discern in this, the hand of Dominic Cummings. I've been meaning to do a blog post on data analytics and government and open data in government for about a month now. And I finally got the kind of kick up the behind to do that by this job advert. So I thought I'd kind of do a piece, which is on the website. It's all about the UK government's weaponization of data analytics. It's quite a controversial blog, because I spelt weaponization with a Z. So I got into a lot of trouble, Computer Weekly, for doing that, breaking the rules. But cast your minds back to, our first podcast of this year, the infamous Dominic Cummings blog, where he was looking for assorted weirdos to join him in Whitehall, software developers, data analysts, who would help him to transform Whitehall. That was podcast number 42. So that we talked about that blog post, which was a very long blog post. Quite a bit of depth we had a wee look at that. And I suppose the rationale for that is the rationale for some of this focus on data analytics and why it's so important. Why Dominic Cummings thinks it's so important is to better forecast. It's all about forecasting better. So pity didn't forecast the coronavirus pandemic. There you go. That's the idea, is to try and bring in excellent data scientists using the best tech. And in the blog post, actually, Cummings went into strange detail about very particular graph technology, databases and things like that. So it was quite a geeky old blog post. But I remember, Claire, you at the time making the point about they probably had in mind a very particular type of person for these roles.
Like, yeah.
White young male in a hoodie.
Yes.
Using R and Python and stuff.
Yeah, it did sound very blokey, hacker in your bedroom targeted, didn't it, at the time?
Yeah, which is just what you need to transform the civil service. Cast your minds back even further. So 10 years ago, David Cameron, newly installed Prime Minister, wrote a letter to all government departments. He did this at the end of May in 2010, telling them to open up all their data for various economic benefits and saving money within government and things like that. It was quite an important letter. But interestingly, Cameron, and he talks about this in his autobiography, he kind of appropriated the idea of data and digital for his government. So his basic line is, his government was digital, and the Blair and Brown government, they were analogue. And as in point of fact, the whole open data initiative within government predates the Cameron government. So I was speaking to Nigel Shadbolt about this. Him and Tim Berners-Lee had been talking to Gordon Brown about open data in government and why it's important and why it's a benefit. But Cameron appropriated that, you know, for his own kind of political capital. Fair enough, you might say. I mean, that's part of the game, maybe. But nevertheless, a little bit cheeky. But similar to what Cummings is maybe doing in appropriating data analytics for his program, David Cameron doesn't like Dominic Cummings very much. But they do, I think, have that in common. It's a very, I don't know, I just think it's a very weird politicisation of data, open data, data analytics. I don't see why it has to be, you know, turned into this weapon. Because Cummings' idea is there are too many arts graduates in the civil service, especially at senior levels, and he wants to get rid of those people, much the same way they're getting rid of Huawei, perhaps. He wants to get rid of those people and replace them with people who are much more attuned to the discipline of data science.
Why can't he just train the people that he already has?
I think that's a really good point.
Like, is there, I mean, I know that data analytics and, you know, like some roles in data analytics can be quite complicated and need quite a long time and a lot of training to sort of get savvy, but can't you just get a couple of people in the top who understand that and then train the others in the basic stuff that they need? Then you have, you know, like these duality people who are both the arts and the science. Pow, pow.
I think that's a perfect point. You know, I've never been a civil servant. I've got some friends who have been civil servants, and yes, they do have arts degrees. So they've maybe done history or politics or English or whatever, but they have to go through this, to get into the civil service, you've got to do this kind of fast stream track exam thing, which actually is very quantitative. There's a lot of logic, you know, solving puzzles involved in it and things like that. So these are people who could be trained and could be made better with statistical methods and things like that. But he really seems to have it in for arts graduates.
What's his degree in?
Ancient history.
Is that not an art?
He is a classicist, as is Michael Gove. He and Michael Gove are sort of, you know, hand in glove over this stuff. And they're both humanities arts graduates from the same university. I don't know. It's a really weird thing. And the other thing that's really weird about it is it's not new. If you go back to the 1960s, Harold Wilson, this is some of the detail of this in the blog post, but, you know, Harold Wilson had initiated a report that said much the same thing. We need to have more statisticians in the civil service, and we need to get civil servants out of London and into other parts of the country, etc., etc. So it's kind of painting what they want to do in a very revolutionary way. But at the same time, the people who they will rely on to deliver change, they're going to war with.
Mm.
You know, it's very, very odd way of going about things, it seems to me. I mean, what about your soft skills and persuading people and bringing people on board and taking them with you, et cetera, et cetera?
Exactly. I mean, I would argue that, you know, being able to understand and manipulate, understand and process data and then use that as evidence for particular things is a transferable skill that you use in lots of different ways, like degrees and exams. Like in history exams at GCSE, you get given sort of like evidence-based like stuff to look at, and then you have to explain based on these pieces of evidence that you've been given why it's relevant to then and now and stuff like that. These are all transferable skills that you can get anywhere from any type of degree, although there is something to be said about the London bubble. But the skills-based stuff, it's just they're not going about it the right way, in my opinion.
So we managed to get through quite a bit of our podcast without mentioning, maybe I did mention COVID-19 once. I think I got away with it. But still on the data science and government topic. So yesterday I wrote up a little story, which I'll put a link to in the summary article, about a forecasting tool from an AI firm called Faculty, which has been built on the NHS COVID-19 data store. And we've been told that this will help to pinpoint kind of upticks in the spread of the coronavirus COVID-19 as we come out of the kind of post-pandemic crisis period, now that the first wave crisis is over. So it's going to be used to help with that, to kind of firefight, if you like. We'll provide, as I said, a link to that story in the summary article and to all the other stories mentioned. So you can read that on computerweekly.com. But you can also subscribe to the podcast and give positive feedback on iTunes.
Yeah, we're going worldwide, baby.
Mm-hmm. I have subscribed. It's one of my favourite podcasts on Apple Podcasts.
Yes. Is it one of your favourite ones featuring someone called Brian McKenna, by any chance?
I wouldn't narrow it down that much. But yeah, we you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes as well as listen to us on computerweekly.com, where you can also read the summary articles with all the links to the stories that we've been talking about. Sadly, that's all we've got time for this week, unless either of you want to unburden a bit more.
No, now it's not the time for any confessionals, I'm afraid. No.
So on this occasion, as ever, it remains for me to say thank you very much to Caroline.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much to Claire.
Anytime.
And thank you, listener, for listening. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.